Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Hello, world. This is Pamela Elaine Lockridge. We are international with the Stop Child Abuse Now radio show. Scan number 2698. Today is Wednesday. And this is special guest night, and we do have a special guest coming on. But before we get to that, I want to talk about NASCA and what we do. NASCA is the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. We are a nonprofit organization, and we've been in existence about 11 years, and we've become really, really, really relevant lately because of all the people that are allowed today to talk about their child abuse. Before, we had to be silent, but no longer. And NASCA, NAASCA.org, at NASCA, we are all about abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with two goals. Number one, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And number two, we offer hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And tonight's special guest, we have Amber Deanne from Reno, Nevada. If anybody's on the show and any background noise happens, just mute your phone until you can take care of the noise, and then we'll get back. Then come back on the show when we go down the panel. So the show's 90 minutes long. We go through the show with three segments. Amber will talk about chronologically her life through her childhood up to about 17, 18 when she became a young adult. And then we'll go to the panel and see if anybody has any comments or questions for her. Remember, it's her story. It's her show. And we need to be very considerate about that and, you know, keep our comments. And you know, if Amber doesn't want to answer a question, she doesn't have to. So, you know, let's try to keep our comments and questions on point. The other thing is the next section will be about her young adult life heading up into midlife. And then we'll go back to the panel, and then at the end we'll talk about her advocacy and her and what she's doing now, you know, on her healing journey. So I'm going to bring Amber on now. Amber's from Reno, Nevada. Amber Deanne, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. We're very glad to have you. to tell your story, and it's very helpful to others to hear that it's okay to tell your story, that it's okay to have a voice, right?
Absolutely.
So before we get into talking about your story, I'm going to read a little bit that I have from your bio. Looks like you had a very rough upbringing, and I'm sad for that. But we're here to support you tonight, and you're no longer there. You're here. Somebody said the past is the past, behind us, and the future is before us, but the present is a gift. So I'm just happy that you're here with us in the present as our gift tonight. And one of the things that you put in quotes was, "I can't cope with life," was the message from your parents. And so when your mom was in an angry state about her life, she would beat you and emotionally belittle you. So let's start out talking about your family, your family of origin, what that was like growing up with your mother and your father and any siblings.
Well, it was challenging to say the least, because before I was born, my parents were living in Omaha, and they both had nice paying jobs at insurance companies. But there was one rule in that insurance company for women. If the woman got pregnant, she goes fired. That's it. No questions asked, no way to keep your job, no nothing. So when my mom was pregnant with me, she got fired. And then Dad had to quit his insurance job because they couldn't afford the rent and everything and on one salary. And then they had to go live with the in-laws, which was my mother's mother. And my mother's mom and my mom never got along well. And so that was a difficult situation in the first place. There was all kinds of family feud going on there. My grandmother didn't like my dad, and he didn't like the fact that they were moving in and they didn't have a job and all kinds of stuff. So there was all that stress and tension. So Mom didn't like her situation, and she didn't like the fact she wasn't working, and she didn't like the fact that she was dependent on her parents. And the whole thing just turned into just a really big mess, and that's why I put that in there, I can't cope with life, because that's kind of what she was feeling, and that's what she was going through. And then there was some sickness on my dad, and everything was just very difficult. And Mom told me once that it took her 3 days to birth me. So that's a very long time. So no wonder she was stressed out. And I think she was trying to abort me while she was pregnant by smoking and drinking. So, yeah, she couldn't cope with life, and she didn't like her whole situation, but there she was, and she had to face it. So there was already anger and frustration between Mom and I when I was born. And I've done some work with the body code people, and they can help you go back in and take a look at all of that nasty stuff from the childhood and everything. And I think there's a time in there when my soul left my body because it couldn't cope with what was going on. You know, my consciousness couldn't cope. When you're a child, you're very dependent on your parents, and to have parents who are trying to abuse you and kill you, you know, it was difficult.
Right.
So that was the early childhood, and then my brother didn't come along until 8 years later, and so I had 8 years of emotional, mental abuse and everything by myself, on myself, from my parents and my grandparents.
Well,
because they weren't happy about the whole situation either.
Physically abuse you, or just verbally? What was the abuse like? What all do you remember? The earliest memory of it starting.
The earliest memory of it was I was like six or something like that. And so here's the problem: I don't have much memory of it, but I have sensations.
Okay.
And the sensations tell me that, and my mom told me, she reinforced this too. She said, told me once, she said, "Well, when you were five, you and the dog ran away from home." So to be five and run away from home, that's kind of serious right there, you know, except it didn't work. The neighbors found us and picked us up and brought us back home again. So that didn't work. So there was, there was lots of, mother exploded a lot when she got angry, and she was thinking about her life and how it could have been different. Then she got mad and angry and exploded on me, and it didn't take much of any little thing to set her off. Like, what used to set her off was the way I opened and closed the window shades in my bedroom. Now, that's a simple little thing, because it's just a flick of your wrist, you know, and you either get the shade up or you don't. Well, and Mom got real upset because I wasn't doing it what she thought was right way, so she started hitting me. And she just went into this rage, and she started just swinging away, like, you know, like she was, you know, trying to save herself, and she was. And she, in the way she was, she was just beating the shit out of me as hard and as fast as she could, and it was traumatic just to believe that she was doing that, and then to try to get away so that I wouldn't be beaten up. And when I talked to her about it days later, she would say, "Oh, I didn't do that." I said, "What do you mean you didn't do it? I saw it. I was right there." She said, "I didn't do that." And then she would just walk away like she didn't take ownership of any of it. And I think the part of it was she didn't recognize that she, her spirit had left her body when she was doing that. And it was another part of her, an angry part of her that was coming in. And then, you know, her angry self and then her loving self, and then they kept flipping in and out. And so you never really knew who was who and who you were talking with. But there were, it didn't take much. There were lots of times when she just beat the shit out of me. And she was always emotionally abusing me, you know, with put downs like I wasn't good enough, or I didn't deserve this, or I would never accomplish that, or I would never make any money, and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't need this, and I didn't need that financially. And it was just very difficult. It was like being in a stress pot all the time, and you were always in survival mode. So I didn't have time to plan a future or enjoy high school or anything, because I was always in survival mode. I never knew what Mom was going to say or do.
Right.
And
so
she was very repressive.
School.
Okay.
Let's talk about school year, like when you entered school. Did anybody know that this was going on? Did you ever tell a teacher or a friend or anybody, or did anybody ever figure out that it was going on?
I don't know that anybody ever did, because I sure never remembered saying anything. But then I don't have very good memory of the first 8 years of my life. And after that, when I got to school, you know, it's just one big foggy gray spot, you know. And I think, and that happens when your soul leaves your body and your memories focus, you know, your memory goes down because of your fight or flight serotonin and levels go up, because you have to protect yourself and defend yourself. And you always have to be on the lookout for the next attack. So
right.
Biologically, it all makes sense. Sorry?
Right. You're not able to think correctly, you know, and reason it out when you're going through it.
Oh, no. No,
you
can't.
You said here that your dad and brother ignored you. Did they ignore what your mother was doing?
My dad noticed it, and he tried to intercede every now and then. So he'd scream at her when she was screaming and at me, but she wasn't even listening, because she was in another state of consciousness. You know, she was like not aware of what even was going on. She was just fuming. She was just getting the stress out of her body. And that's what people do when they rage. They have to get all that anger pain out of themselves, so they just splat it on whoever's around. And I was always one to get splat on. And because
Did her mother do the same thing to her? Did her mother do the same thing to her?
I'm not sure, but I know from early childhood, when I always had to go along when Mom went down to pick up Grandma to take her into town to get groceries and stuff. And that happened for a number of years, because Grandma lived alone at least 30 years after her husband died. And she lived on a farm, and she didn't drive. So we had to take care of her. And during that time, all the time, my mom and my grandma were fighting, arguing all the time. So I think this is a generational thing that's been handed down. Yes, I think it was. I never saw them hit each other or any of that stuff because they were a little civilized over that. But when my grandmother was, when my mother was small, my grandmother had had a nervous breakdown. And so she was in the hospital for a while, and then she came home, and then she was in bed. And so she was like years just barely, you know, coping and getting up to take care of the family and the farm and all that stuff. And so mom felt neglected and abandoned, you know. So you look at the generational stuff that's happening there, and there's a lot, right? And so a lot of that just turned into anger at in my mom at her life, and she just splatted out and she got rid of it. And I don't think she has any consciousness of what she was doing to me. Cared, you know, because she just couldn't deal with it. She just couldn't deal with life. I can't cope with life, you know.
Did she ever end up in the hospital? No, she never ended up in a mental hospital.
No, she never did. She never had any kind of, it seemed like mental problems or anything like that. After my father died, she developed coronary pulmonary disease, because that's because she smoked all those years. And I never knew about it because she was a closet smoker. And so after my dad died of lung cancer because he smoked, and then she came down with coronary pulmonary, which is almost the same thing as lung cancer. She couldn't breathe. And so she fought for like 14 years. She would be in and out of the hospital with this illness, when not able to breathe. And so she'd be fighting for her breath all the time. And my brother would go into the hospital to see her and take care of her and take care of her needs and whatever, you know. And he just said, he was just fit to be tied, and he just couldn't cope with watching her being in so much pain. So she suffered a lot in a different way. Yeah. So there's a whole lot of general, we may not know how important it is to know our ancestry, but boy, when you deal with issues like this, you certainly recognize how important it is to deal
Absolutely.
With your ancestors and try to understand where they're coming from, so you can protect yourself and so you can try to calm them down. And so it was when I was 10 years old, I finally talked my family into buying me a piano. And that was an unheard of thing, because we weren't musical family, you know. Nobody heard of that, you know, except my grandfather on the dad's side. So, but they agreed to, and they did it. And my learning to play piano was the best thing that ever happened to my mom, because it calmed her down. And so I played piano all through from time I was 10 until I was like 14, 15 or something like that, and went off to high school, and then I didn't have much time. But I would play after that. And I was nice enough, though, to play my mother's favorite songs, which was Christmas carols and some religious music that she liked. So that would help a lot. But, you know, this was in the 50s and the early 60s, and there wasn't the mental health programs that we have now, and there wasn't the psychologists and the psychiatrists and all those experts, you know, and there wasn't anything about family relationships and family trauma and inherited family trauma and all that stuff. All those books have come out since then, and thank God, because they're beautiful. Lots of cool information in there. And if it wasn't for those books, I would not even have recognized today, you know, what all my issues were and what my problems
Absolutely.
Were and that I needed to deal with them. But because I read all those books because I wanted to heal, then that all came up. And thank goodness that was all available now. So it's pretty sad what those people had to go through. And then Mom had a lot of trauma too, because when she was in high school, it was the war years, the World War II.
Absolutely.
And there was so,
right.
You know how that was, World War II, you know, everything was rationed, and there wasn't any fun and there wasn't much of any activities that you could do because everything had to go to the war effort. And so look at what a traumatic thing that was for her to have to deal with. And then she married a man, and then I think she turned out after a while, and I think her and dad never got along all that well. So I think as the years passed, you know, she started to realize, oh, I may have made a mistake here. Maybe I shouldn't have married this guy because this isn't the kind of life I want, you know. But then it's too late. There was no such thing in those days as divorce.
That's right.
So
absolutely.
So women were, you know, so women were stuck in a lot of different ways. And a lot of this was stuff that she had to deal with, but she had no resources. So I can understand and I can be sympathetic toward that. And once I started to talk with her etherically and start feeling what her life was like, then I could start dropping some of my resentments and angers against her and all
okay,
that. And I, sure.
Let's stay with your, I have a question to kind of, you know, we got 90 minutes, so, you know, we don't want to go forward and tell the story. One of my questions is, how did they treat your brother when he came along? How was he treated? Was he bigged up? Was he treated the same way as you?
No. He was treated totally different because it's that patriarchy thing, and that patriarchy thing still exists in the agriculture community. And because we were farmers, all of that, he was groomed from the time he was 3 months old to be a farmer. And he was a good farmer, and he still is a good farmer, and he's farming the farm, the family farm, and he's doing a great job. So he was treated in a much different way. He was respected and appreciated, and he was honored, and he was worshipped, and almost everything, you know. He was treated like a prince. Because
that's
just
me,
how it is, then, you know,
Well, what makes me, comes to mind when I think of that is that I wanted to say, well, they didn't know how to parent. But I can't say that because they knew how to parent him. So why didn't they parent you that way? You know, why didn't they use the same parental skills that they were using with him to parent you as something worse something? But they treated you totally different because they felt he was worthy and
well,
you weren't, right? Because you say you felt emotionally belittled.
Yes.
And you felt worthless and helpless and constant anger and hate of your mother. And it was just totally different from you is what it sounds like.
It was totally different because, see, I changed their lifestyle. And by the time my brother came along, my dad was loving farming, although my mother never did. My dad loved it, and so he loved having a son and grooming him and working with him on the farm and all of that stuff. And so he was just respected and honored a lot more. He was given a lot more responsibility at a very young age, not only responsibility over his life, but also responsibilities on the farm. And there were times he was given control over me because it was felt that I needed to be controlled. I don't know why they thought I would get out of hand or whatever, but whenever the parents left to go someplace in the evening, and my brother was over 8 by that time, then he would be in charge of watching over me. And they thought that was real cute, you know. But I think it was they're trying to groom him and help him grow into a man. And so they were giving him all these responsibilities, but he was totally incapable of dealing with it because he had no idea how to deal with other people. That we had no others. There were no other siblings. There was nobody younger than him.
Right.
And he just had his friends at school were his age, you know, so he didn't know how to deal with younger people. And we didn't have any cousins or anything like that that were younger so that he could, you know, learn parenting skills. So he didn't. And so he just would control me, and then he'd be bossing and, you know, emotionally abusive to me too, just like he saw Mom being. And so he just kind of adopted that attitude. It was very difficult. It was very difficult for me.
Sure,
I felt stuck. I felt stuck all the time, you know. Like, no, I can't do anything right, and I can't go anywhere, and I can't do anything, and I can't be with any of my friends and everything. So I could play the piano, and I could go to school. And then when I got to high school, they let me play an instrument in the band because they knew I liked music, and that didn't seem offensive to them. So that was it. But social activities, social clubs, doing the normal routine of and the curriculum for the high school, no, that was not allowed. I had to be home to help out because we had we had a garden. We had animals, you know. We butchered our own chickens and we raised beef and then we had it butchered. And so there was yard work and there were flowers. And Mom was really obsessed with flowers. And so I had to be there to help with all of that. She didn't want the responsibility of that all by herself. So I was not allowed to do a lot of things in high school. And that has really harmed me to this.
It sounds like they didn't put a lot of stock in education. But they didn't back then, did they? Especially if you lived on a farm, it wasn't about education, it was survival.
Education wasn't important at all. It was survival. It was keeping up with the latest farm trends. It was coping with the weather, the bugs, the drought, the floods, the whatever was coming along, and surviving so that you made enough money so that you could make the payments on the farm equipment, and so you could buy the seeds and the fuel and the hydrous ammonia and all the bug killers and the weed killers and all that kind of stuff that you had to do. It's totally survival. And so how can a woman contribute to survival of the farm? Not much. So that's why she was honored and respected and groomed, and I was not.
So did you feel like they overworked you, like they used to do things beyond your ability, or do you think it was in line with what you could do?
Well, physically, there were limitations to what I could do, but there was always work to do, and Mom always expected me to do the work, and so did Dad, and they were expecting me to do things that I was not qualified for and capable of, like walking on the roof of the sheds to help Dad shingle. That was a little scary for me, and so I didn't do that well, so I got fired. I got fired a lot by my dad because when I would try to help him with things, because it was just never good enough. And so that was some of that early childhood resentment against me because I was born a female, and if I'd been born a male, he could have groomed me, and I would have had the physical strength to do all those things he wanted done around the farm.
Right. So can we go to the panel now? And we've got two gentlemen on hold that have been listening and may want to interact with you. Would that be okay?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to bring John on from Louisiana. John, you're on with Amber.
Yeah. Hi, Amber.
Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay.
Great. Listen, I am the vice president of SVSA. We are a survivals network, and we also offer any type of support for both men and women at any given time, and everything is free. So if you ever need us for anything, first of all, we'll always be there for you, okay?
Okay.
You know, listening
yeah,
to
I'd
your
love
story,
to explore that a little bit more.
Listening
yeah.
to your story, it's very devastating as a young person to go through such a negative life early, you know, because it does weigh on, you know, a lot of things that you raised on, the way things are through the homestead and everything else. But I'm very impressed to hear about the music end of it, because I'm a musician myself, okay? I play songs every day. I play piano and guitar. And, you know, and I hope you can find, you know, some positives out of, you know, the negative side of it, you know, that you've lived through, because you brought it up several times. You know, it seems like it's a huge part of your life. And I hope that you can keep playing the rest of your life, you know, and use that, you know, for therapy, because I do it every single day. I'm a 45-year survivor. So, you know, with that, I hope that you can find, you know, a lot of good positives in your life away from all the negatives. But I did have a couple quick questions for you. You know, being so young when everything happened to you, and through a lot of part of your life, you know, later on, a lot of survivors, they you know, develop a lot of issues, you know, and then they have like a lot of what they call repressed memories, okay? And usually it's later on in life, which causes a lot of trauma, and people need therapy of all kinds, you know, depending on, you know, their personal situation. So, you know, did you reach a certain age where you had a lot of repressed memories from those times in your life where you just had enough inside? You know, did you have issues with fibromyalgia and, you know, things of that nature, PTSD, anything, you know? And how old were you if you did?
I had all of those issues.
Uh-huh.
And when I was young, I had chronic constipation and chronic colds. So I would have 3-4 colds a winter, and it would last for months each time. So most of the winter I was blowing my nose and sneezing and all that stuff, which was annoying to the family, and it was hard on me. But it was like my second nature, because I had had that all my life. And when I got older, then I realized that constant colds is, you know, an immune system issue. And so that made sense that I had that, because when you're always in fight or flight, you're always trying to protect yourself, and then your immune system suffers.
Correct.
And your nervous system suffers. And the whole, I'm learning that whole biology of trauma now, because over COVID,
yes.
I was listening to lots of the summits by the doctors and the functional medicine people. And there was a lot of information in there, which was very interesting about, you know, the biologies and how things don't function well in your body when you're under long-term stress. And I've had PTSD all my life. Yeah, I just didn't recognize it until, you know, several years ago, like 10 or 12, 15 years ago, I started recognizing that. And I have flashbacks, I have mental flashbacks, I still do, but they're, now it's not so bad. Now I can kind of turn them off. I can kind of put another thought on, you know, in my mind and let them roll off. But the thoughts of the beatings and the humiliation and all that stuff. it definitely had a long-term effect on me, lots of ways. And the fibromyalgia, I've just developed this past couple of months. Once I moved to Reno, then I had a major flash of, and I recognized that, now I'm in fibromyalgia and I have to deal with it. But luckily, I found some good healthcare people here, functional medicine people, who are helping me through the whole thing. So I'm just doing the process, and it's working tremendously well. But I also have to work with diet and supplements and emotional healing. There's a lot of emotional healing that goes with all of this.
Right.
And because emotional healing, it means you change your energy in your body, which allows, when you raise your energy, then it allows your body to be healthier and cast
That's
off
exactly
all the
right.
things that you had. And so part of, major part of fibromyalgia, dealing with that, you also have to deal with leaky gut and inflammation, which are mm-hmm. also part of the autoimmune system responses, which is all triggered by a nervous system that can't quiet down and shut down.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I can tell you've done an extensive amount of research on it all, and anybody I think that's here on this panel agrees with everything you said, because we all live the same life that way. It's amazing that you found a good place over there to take care of you, and that's what needs to be done, you know. And I hope that you can find any positive outlook on what's happened to you, you know. And we'll always be here for you, okay?
Thank you.
And it was very nice to meet you too.
I would love to have more information about your organization.
Yeah, anytime. We got our own website. You got to punch in www first, and then scsa.org. So we have a women's division and a men's. I run the men's division on the support side and media, a vice president, along with Rich
mm-hmm.
and Women. And, you know, we just, along with NASA, I mean, you cannot find better people, Amber, to find support,
cool.
have support. I'm telling you, I would not be here today if I didn't know what I'm talking about. These people are beautiful, okay? So
mm-hmm.
We will always be here if you need something, okay?
Okay. Thank you so much, John.
All right. Okay. Bye.
Thanks.
John, I'm going to go to Mark. Mark from Louisiana. You're on with Amber.
Yes, Amber. I'm sorry that you had to go through that trauma as a child. Did you even have a chance to be a little girl when you were going through all that? Were you always in a survival mode? Did you ever have any thoughts that little girls have, like playing with dolls, or little girl visions and wants and desires, or were you always in a flight mode?
Well, I do have memories of playing with some dolls, and I do have memories of my cousins coming over and playing with certain dolls, and I remember certain paper dolls that I have. And there were other dolls that I have. And as I get older, I develop kind of an intuitive sense. So I had this doll, and she was like a baby doll, but, you know, a little bit older. And she had like plaster Paris kind of body type. And then she had real hair. And I noticed that her mouth was always kind of busted up. And I was wondering what that was. And then all of a sudden one day I saw the picture of it was, you know, as mom was beating me, I was beating up on my doll. That's how I was getting rid of the frustration. So I was trying to shove a spoon down her throat and a bunch of other stuff. And I was kind of abusive to my doll. And she got a little wrecked, you know. And I had other dolls that were beautiful that would sit on my bed and just look pretty. And my folks would take me to ride horses, and we would go, you know, out to picnics and things with the family and other things like that. So there was a little bit of social life, but the piano and music was the thing that really got me through all of those times. And poetry. And poetry was a good thing, too. When I got into grade school and I could read poetry, then I would come home and I would recite poetry. And it would kind of take the edge off, you know, all the harshness that was around. Because there were a lot of things I was not allowed to do, especially as I got older. But when I was a kid, I could go, you know, ride horses when we would go to the fair or something like that. So there were a few things I was allowed to do. I wasn't allowed to do art. I wasn't allowed to read books. And I don't know what that was all about, except that mom thought that I was taking my time and energy when I needed to be putting it to yard work or or dealing with the produce or dealing with animals or doing something, you know, with her, the dishes or the laundry or something like that. She always needed help with all of that stuff.
Were you allowed to have friends over to your house, or is that a no-no?
No. When I was 5 years old, I had a birthday party, and I don't remember it, but there are pictures of it. Mom kept a photo album of all little activities that we both of us kids did. So she was constantly taking little pictures and putting it in the photo album. And so because of that, I can go back, you know, and I can see what happened all those years that I don't have a memory.
Right.
So I did have a birthday party when I was five, but after that, I don't remember having much of anything.
So when you went to school, or were you allowed, I know you were saying earlier that the agricultural environment schooling wasn't really that important, but did you find that when you went to school that was a safe place for you, or was it just, you know, one of those places where you had to go for a while and then you had to go back home? Or but my question is, was it a safe place for you? Did you feel that way?
Yes. I loved going to school. I loved school. And that's why after I got out of grade school, then I was excited to go to high school and then excited to go to college. And then I did some postgraduate work. So I loved going to school and everything. It was a way to get away from mom, and it was a way to learn new things. And I was one of the taller kids in school. And I went to a country grade school. There were 8 grades, 16 students, and 1 teacher. So that's totally unheard of now. But that was what it was then, you know. And my brother started in that school, too. And then the school district changed, and then they sold the school, and then everybody got bused to Blair, which was the local town and everything. But I had a ball in grade school, because we had recess 3 times a day and before and after school. So we played games. We played pom-pom polio, and we'd have baseball, and we'd have, and the winter would snow on that hill, so we'd ski, and then we'd have fox and goose chase, and we would do, it was just fun. You could get out and get some exercise. The teacher believed you needed fresh air and exercise in order to get your brain to work and so you could make it through your studies. And then one of the really rough days when it was really windy and bad weather, and we were on a hill, and so the window panes would shake and all that stuff. So on those days, then she would read to us at noon hour. And for holidays, we had fun at holidays. We had a Valentine's Day party, and we had a Christmas pageant. And with the Christmas, they'd build a stage, and then we'd have a Christmas program, and then I'd get to play piano, and then everybody would get to do their little poems or sayings or play their little story, you know, and that was a Christmas thing. And every summer we would have a picnic at the end of the school, and then all of the families would bring something, a potluck dish, and then we would cook out and have a potluck dish, and everybody could get acquainted with each other and what they were doing and everything. And then we'd have, on your birthdays, you would bring a treat for everybody else. And then we did craft things. So one of the craft things we did that I remember that I liked really well was we would do wood carving. Excuse me. So we would have burning guns, you know, burning guns, and we would burn wood, and we put decorations on them. And we play other games down in the basement of the school. So school was a saving place for me, and I really loved it, and I excelled. I finally, after the first couple of years, I was almost flunking out, but then something shifted, and my energy shifted, and then I could get into the routine of going to school, and then my folks were always pushing, you know, for me to get really good grades. So there was a lot of pressure to get good grades because they wanted me to get a scholarship in high school to get to college.
Yeah, so in high school, did the beating slow down?
When you entered high school, did the beatings slow down?
Yes.
Did the verbal?
Yeah. Yeah, the beatings were mostly, by that time I was as big as Mom was, and, you know, I was tall, and she was, probably she figured she wasn't going to beat me up anymore. But the emotional and mental abuse never ceased. It went on until the day she died. And I, by that time I was in my 40s. So that was a long stretch. And I have flashbacks, and I still remember some things, and I still have nerve reactions to things she was doing and all that. But I was allowed to do a certain thing. I was allowed to sit and needlepoint while everybody else was watching television. That's what I was allowed to do, and that was it. And they let me get a baton and have some baton lessons as if to be majorette, because that was a big thing then. And I tried out to be majorette, and I didn't get it, and that was a good thing, too, because it was because of the weather. It was very cold some of the times when we had to march in parades and contests and that kind of stuff. And I got to be in some with a small group instrumentals that were associated with the band, and we would go to other local schools in the Blair area and the Omaha area, I mean, and we would compete. And we were very good in the music department, so we always got high awards, and that was a lot of fun. So I got out a few times to get to go to those kind of events.
So when you left high school, what happened then? Was your mom trying to keep you home, or was she excited about you going to leave? It said you wanted to get away from your mom.
Yeah, I wanted to get away from my mom. What I was telling you was all grade school. So when I got to high school, then I had to drive into town, or mother had to drive me the first couple of years, and that's when I wasn't allowed to do all the participation and other group activities that the other people were doing. I couldn't be in pep club. I couldn't be in home ec. I couldn't take Spanish. I couldn't take science classes. I couldn't take advanced math, all that kind of stuff, I wasn't doing very good in math, and so Mother knew math and science wouldn't work or any of that stuff. So I wasn't allowed to do all of those things, and I had to be at this certain place in the school where they could pick me up so they could take me home, because that was an inconvenience for them to have to drive me into school and pick me up from school for the first 2 years. So that was a big inconvenience, and so they weren't going to allow any kind of extracurricular activities there. So I felt really out of it and alone, and I feel like I never could belong to anything. And that has been a major problem in my life forever, you know, not feeling I belong. And it's not so much that I don't feel worthy of it. It's just that I don't have social skills that I think I need. Because I didn't have a chance to develop social skills in high school.
Right.
And it was the same way in college. I was kind of pushed out and ignored and avoided in college, too. So I focused on my studies, because I was going to accomplish something and make something of my life through education.
So
other
people pushed you away in college? Why do you think they pushed you away?
I just wasn't fun and happy person. I was serious and studious, and I didn't know how to, you know, have fun except with a certain people who were just like me and were from the country, you know, I couldn't relate to city people. I just couldn't relate to city people.
Uh-oh.
They had so much different life, you know.
You're right.
And
you're right. Oh. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
it was
totally
so
different.
Let's talk about, you talked here in your bio about inner emotional conflict about your value, which you're kind of talking about now. You didn't feel like you fit in. And then after you left college and you turned 30, that's when you started having to really, your repressed memories forced you to be honest about your feelings towards your parents, your revenge actions, your buried self-image and self-respect issues.
That was all triggered because I was not only feeling alone, but I couldn't land a job that I liked. And so I would flop from job to job and apartment to apartment, and then I would move from Omaha to Lincoln to Des Moines, Iowa, to here, to the Fremont, you know. I was bopping in and out through all those places trying to find a job that fit. But here was the problem. It was I graduated from college in 72, and I wanted to get into accounting, not because I was so good with math, but because I thought it would be a decent job and it would make the family proud of me. And I was always trying to make the family proud of me. So that's why I worked, you know, everything they wanted me to do on the farm, make the family proud of me, find a way to be accepted. And that never worked, no matter what I did. So that whole, I don't fit in, I'm not accepted, followed through after college in all the jobs that I had. And I found all these jobs, but they didn't appreciate me at all. And I was doing work that I wasn't happy with. It was clerical work. I did years and years and years of clerical work. And you're never appreciated. You don't never make a decent living. And there's no way to go, no place to go. And you know, I wasn't out dating and, you know, trying to date somebody who was wealthy and rich and all that stuff, because I didn't have that self-esteem. I didn't have that self-confidence. So all those things that I've talked about were far greater, I think, than the physical beatings, because they've had a far deeper effect on my whole life than just the physical beatings.
Right.
Although that's hard to understand too when you're a kid, you know.
So did you ever have a good relationship with anybody, a friend, you know, after your 30s, a friend or a boyfriend husband?
No, I married an alcoholic just so I could get away from Mom. I figured that way there would be enough distance between Mom and I so that I could eventually, you know, live my life and find myself. And that didn't work. They kept coming, dropping by and, you know, this and that. And so, and then he had a girlfriend on the side and he was an alcoholic. And so after a year and a half of that marriage, it ended. And then because of the patriarchal society that existed in Nebraska in the 70s and the 80s, I wasn't able to get into public accounting firms or any kind of accounting firms. The clerical jobs was all I could do, no matter what my, you know, education was and my resume was. And I've had many times where I was just rejected from jobs because of my gender. And that was emotionally abusive, too. I've had men emotionally abusive to me and say, once I wanted to work at a bank. And so I just walked in and had my resume and they said, you know, I came to apply for a job. I'd like to know who to talk to and what kind of openings you have. And the guy got up and he walked me to the door and he opened the door and he said, we don't hire women. And he slammed the door shut.
Oh, my goodness.
He pushed me through and he slammed the door shut. That was it. And he walked up. That was a bank in the 70s Omaha, Nebraska. So see, it was not only all the oppressiveness from the family, but then it all was all accelerated from jobs I tried to get and social life I tried to get. So I was lucky enough that I had a couple of friends in college. And we stayed in contact all these years, and we still, you know, talk, and we hang out now and then and all that stuff. And so that's what got me through, is those friendships is what got me through all those years. And I made a couple other short-term friendships, but then friends would all leave. They would all get married and move away. And so that shifted everything, too. So that increased my feelings of abandonment and feeling deserted and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's been difficult.
Okay.
So I didn't have many boyfriends after that, and nothing ever worked out financial, in the social department like that after that. So that's why I'm still single.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go back to the panel, and we're going to keep our comments and questions about what you have just discussed, because then we're going to get back and move on, okay? So
I'm
going to open John's mic and see what John has to say about what we've been discussing, John, about what she shared.
Yes. Well, Amber, you know, you've been such... through a lot of hardship in your life, and you've been through a lot of moving and, relationship issues. Where are you at now in your life? I mean, are you doing anything specifically to play? Are you playing music still? Or are you doing, any kind of therapy to get through what you've been through?
I gave up a piano when I moved off to college, and then my parents sold the piano. So a year ago, I did buy a keyboard, but I haven't found the time to get back in to do the keyboard. So what I'm doing now was I've accumulated a lot of books because I wanted to study the family situation and emotional abuse and trauma and all that stuff. So I studied that for many, many years and accumulated quite a library. And then I moved into doing some writing. So I wrote for some articles for some magazines and newsletters for co-ops, food co-op. That was in the 80s after I got out of law school. And then I loved that. And then I started trying to write novels and movie scripts and all that. And then I got into acting. So that was amazing when I got into it. I never went very far with acting, but I loved taking acting lessons, and I loved doing writing when I was in college. And so I'm still doing writing. I'm still I still submit to any writing organizations and publications and stuff like that. In fact, I'm going to do some more tonight. And then I got into some art. And I just love art, so I love to paint.
What kind of art?
I was doing finger painting when I got started, and then I moved into acrylics. So now I'm doing acrylics, it's kind of still life. And now I want to do expressive art, and I want to help other people because there's so much you can clear out of yourself, and you can find yourself once you learn to do expressive art.
Oh, girl, I want to see some of your stuff. I mean, how can I, I guess at the end we can find out, how to get in touch with each other, because I'd love to see some of your artwork. And I really would love for you to get back into some music, okay?
I would love to get back into music.
You can't leave the music alone. You can't let it go. It'll come back in your life.
Right.
You know?
Yes, it is.
That is great. Great to hear.
After Nebraska, then I moved to Iowa, and then I had a nice bank job for a year, and then the bank went bankrupt, and then I had to leave. And so then I ended up in Sacramento for my spirit guide, Sacramento, California. So while I was there, I would be hanging out with groups that play drums in the park. And we would play drums and rattles and other instruments. And it was just expressive, spontaneous rhythms. We had no singer. We weren't ever on the stage or any of that stuff. But that was so lovely. That was so cool. I could sit and play the drums.
I've heard of that
with
before.
Sound, just with rhythm.
Yeah.
Just with rhythm.
I've heard of that before.
Oh, yes. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So,
that's great.
And so I missed that. And then I got into some Hindu chanting. I was chanting Sanskrit. I was hanging out with some spiritual people.
Right.
Of the Hindu religion, and I love that too. And I just
good for you.
And I just love to sing and chant Sanskrit. So
that's awesome. It sounds like you have an extensive background, with your music, and that's look. Don't ever let that go in your life. It doesn't matter what you're going through. it sounds like it's a huge part of your life. And from what I've heard all night long, every time that you come on and you are happy, everything else is, it's about the music you brought up, you know, so stay with that. And I'm doing the same thing. I'm just going to tell you, my music is my life, you know.
Yes.
So so happy to hear that from you. And keep it up, you know, and keep acting. Why don't you go back and get in to maybe
I want to.
You know?
All I was able to do when I was in Sacramento, California, was I would hang out with the writers groups, the screenwriters groups, and I wrote a couple of screenplays, and I like them a lot. They're comedies, and I want to, and then I wrote two books while I was in Sacramento. One was about my life going through the trauma of child abuse and everything until I found my higher self and my inner soul, and I called that Release Your Magical Child. And I want to get out and get that out into the public, you know, sell the books and teach a classes based on those. And then I wrote another book after that. And then I've written, and then when I was hanging out with the script writers and the movie people, then I got to be extra in several movies. And they were
excellent.
Famous movies. They were famous movies. And even though I was just an extra, you know, I didn't have lines and all that kind of stuff, it was exciting as can be being on the set, the movie set.
Wow.
And so that,
yeah, I've been on the few myself.
So that's what got me really excited about wanting to write scripts, movie scripts, and see those produced. And I still have that dream. And I have a dream of moving forward with my art and doing expressive art classes in the near future. And that kind of thing. So yes. So I write some poetry. I've put some rhyming poetry, kind of Dr. Seuss style. And I've done a couple of videos that I put up on YouTube that kind of a melody and a rhythm like Dr. Seuss would have. And I have so much fun doing those. It's fantastic. And I love nature, so I hang out with nature when I get depressed. So I've been able to continue with some of those things, but like I just said, I just moved to Reno a few months ago, and I'm just beginning to get connected with some people here. But I like the people I'm connected with, so I hang out with Unity Church and a couple other things that I try to do that are related to personal development. But that's kind of my life, you know. I wish I could broaden my life a little bit more and get out and do more social activities. And maybe with COVID, you know, and the virus thing ending, maybe that'll happen. Okay.
Well, Amber, all I can say is that you have come a long way, and I'm very happy to hear all the compliments, you know, that you've reached by now. So keep it up, and God bless you too, okay?
Thank you. Thank you. And I would love to talk with you when this is over.
Sure.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Thank you, John. I'm gonna get you John's information through Facebook private message like I did another gentleman the other night. But thank you, John.
Good.
You're right on encouraging her to do her art and things like that. And as a matter of fact, you know, I wanted to get a painting done by somebody that reflects, you know, my life, because I go and I exhibit my books, and I'd like to have a painting that would go along with my book. So when people purchase the book, they can purchase the painting. So the print, you know.
Okay.
So I would love for you to design that for me, or do that artwork for me, and we could work together to get it done.
Let me show you what I've done so far. I'm going to finish a couple of paintings that I started here, and then you can get some idea. You know, I'm just beginning to get into expressive art, but it's so much fun. I just lose myself, and I float into another world when I'm doing the art, and when I'm writing poetry or short stories or whatever too. So
I was thinking what I could do is talk to you about my life and my journey, and you could do the the artwork while I'm telling it to you, and how it turns out at the end it will be my print.
Well, that's an idea. We'll have to see if that works. I just don't want you to be disappointed, because this is expressive art. This isn't fine art or book cover art or anything like that. But I did have a lot of fun putting together the book cover. You just want expressive art?
I know what you're talking about. Kind of like an abstract that doesn't really probably make much sense to anybody but me, but I can explain it to others. So anyway.
I want to go to
a line that you have in your bio. You said, I found spirituality through a 12-step program. Define spirituality through a 12-step program for us, for the audience, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. Sure, no problem. Okay. When I was in Des Moines, Iowa, I was attending the 12-step programs, the ACA, because I wanted that kind of relationship. And I was able to start to build some friendships there, and it was fun. I was active in the club. So once twice a year, they would have a retreat, and certain people, if you found out about it and you paid your fee in advance, you could go to the retreat. And the retreat was about working with your emotional issues that you had as an abused child. So that was the very first time I got to sit down and look at all those issues. And by this time I was, I'd be in my 30s, I guess, late 20s, 30s. Yeah, probably late 30s. And so we would all sit around a table and we would have this sheet of paper and have questions on it, and we would have to answer those questions. And it was all about feeling. It wasn't about thinking. It was about feeling. Because when you're an abused child, what gets shut down first? All your feelings, because you can't cope with them. So that was when I got to really feel and express myself and start to see that, there is a way out of this paper bag problem that I seem to have and I can't get out of it. So I just kept going with that, and then I was able to write that into my book and into some blogs and all that other kind of stuff when I became a life coach later on. But it was amazing. And when you understand your feelings, your emotions, then you automatically are led into your spirit, because those two together work to give you guidance for your life. So you have to feel where you're at, no matter how much the pain or the joy or the uncomfort or the uncertainty or the confusion or whatever, you feel that, and that leads you into spirituality, which is a connection with your spirit, your higher self, and your inner child. So that's what I call spirituality. Right. It has nothing to do with religion. It doesn't come out of a church anywhere.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, different folks have different takes on what that means to them, and that's why I wanted your take and how it related to you.
Sure.
And then you said you've written a book called Mental Reset, Power Tools and Strategy to Reset Your Mind for Success.
Yes.
And
yes.
You talk about the 12-step program.
I didn't talk about the 12-step program in there. I talked about how I was feeling. One time I owned a house in Sacramento, and I rented rooms out, and the people who were coming to rent the rooms were addicts. They were drug and alcohol addicts. Not all of them, but some of them. And that got to be really difficult. And so I talk about starting from there, starting feeling totally, I've had it with these people. I'm getting rid of all of them. And I'm going to shift my ideas about life and my ideas about how to live life. And I don't have to live it by other people's rules. That's when I started setting out kind of on my own journey. And so I did. So the book talks about how to identify those feelings and work through all of those stages of emotion that you need to get to feel empowered and in control of your life again. And then I add some yoga postures to that and some affirmations and other things. So it's a really cute little book, and it integrates the emotions, the thoughts, and the actions that you need to feel empowered and move forward.
You put that quite well. You're very articulate. You said designing an you're designing an expressive Zoom class.
It's for helping people who have had child abuse issues, who kind of have lost touch with themselves, and so it's going to be expressive art, and it's going to incorporate things that we need to in order to feel connected with our bodies. So it's integration of different mind body techniques. So it's going to include breathing and prayer and connecting with your subconscious so that when you sit down to paint something, you can really paint your feelings. You're not like painting a chicken, you know, you're not painting a bird. You're painting how you feel. And it doesn't have to look like anything, and because you're not going to frame and put it on the wall. It's your expression. It's your self-expression. And once you connect with that, that is the way your subconscious talks to you through pictures. And it's a way to illuminate what you feel deep, deep, deep down inside. And it's a way to get those deep feelings up and out so that you can look at them and say, okay, these are some new issues I have to work on, and how am I going to do it? Because I've been doing a lot of that, the integrating of the mind and the body, and I've done some classes on this. There's a brain gym, which is really good, one of the exercises that I do. And it helps you, what it helps you do is connect, release your emotions. It's connect to your emotions and then release those emotions through the energy channels of your body, your chakras. And once you can do that.
Is it very complicated?
No, it's not complicated. You just have to bring your body into your life. And that's the thing that I noticed a lot once I first started this process, you know, like 15 years ago. I was not connected to my body. I was my energy, people would look at my aura and they say, your aura doesn't go all the way to your feet. It ends at your knees. And so I had to mentally use my imagination and pull my aura back into my body. And then I had to learn to touch my body again and like my body and appreciate my body. Then I had to listen to the messages that were coming through when I had an ache or a pain or an illness or something like that. That's what I call the integration. You have to bring your body back into your life.
Well, let me ask you a question. What would you say to a person, and I'll just use me because it's kind of happening to me. What would you say to a person that's happy and has everything going for them in life, but they just want to stay in the bed all the time? Not lazy, because when I get up, I can work my A off, but it's just so comfortable and maybe I'm just wanting that fetal, that inner, you know, the womb sense. You know what I'm saying? I want to stay in the womb, but I want to get out of the womb. I don't want to stay in the womb.
You understand what I'm saying? I understand exactly, because I go through the same thing every day. It's called depression. And it's a depression about waking up. And here's the thing. When you wake up in the morning, you already have more cortisol than you have an elevated sense of cortisol, which you don't need. Because you don't need an elevated sense of cortisol when you wake up in the morning. You're not going to fight a tiger, right? And you're not going to run away you're not going to run away from a wolf. So it's like that's another thing of, what I've learned is that you have to flip the switch on your nervous system. You have to reset it just like you reset an electrical outlet, you know, the kind that has the red button and the green button. And then if you plug your hair dryer in and it doesn't work, you hit the red button or the green button. You hit one of those and then it reactivates the electric circuit. Well, when you've been traumatized, and your electric system, meaning your nervous system, doesn't work completely, and it never shuts off. It never goes from high to low to off. That's the problem with our nervous systems. We don't have a way to get down to low and off. So we don't have a way to be peaceful, and we're our feeling peaceful is when we're wake up in the morning and, you know, we're cozy and we're comfortable and there's no trauma and there's no crisis and there's no problem to solve. We're just finally at that peaceful state, and we love it so much that we don't want to get out of bed and get on with the day. And that's the time because of the cortisol, because sometimes that's when my depression thoughts start, that I have to conquer those, push through all of those, find something to activate myself to get out of bed, something that I really want to do, and then get up and move forward and do it. And so for your situation, it could be a lot different. It's what I'd have to look at it psychically, and then I could help you work through those issues. Because I do energy transfusion. I learned energy transfusion is a fantastic tool to help you get rid of stress, trauma, tensions, all that kind of stuff.
I know. It's like you said, everything's so in its place and so calm now. And it's so much, my life is so much different. I don't know how to act. I don't know how to relate.
Yes.
Because for so long.
Yes. Isn't that
and
nice?
So I'm like,
we finally get to a point where life is calmed down and we don't have to run away from, you know, somebody who's going to abuse us or yell at us or scream at us because we're living alone. That's why we live alone. It's nice and peaceful.
Well, it's very nice, but at the same time, it's like out of balance some way. And I don't know what's causing the out of balance.
Yes. You totally got
it's almost
it.
Like,
you totally got it.
It's almost like I don't want to get up and live because I'm so comfortable just thinking, you know, my life is complete and I don't have anything else to do, even though I'm sure I can find things to do.
Yeah. Well, if you've gotten to that state where your life is complete and you can just, like, hang out in bed, well, congratulations. You've made it. You're doing pretty good. Man, you're doing fantastic. I envy you.
So, I'm thinking it's a problem when it's a non-problem.
It's a non-problem, yeah. Well, in some states, unless there's a reason you're doing that, you know, maybe you're afraid of doing something or going somewhere or, you know, confronting somebody or some situation like that where you have to at your best, or where you have to be in a protective mode, you know, something like that. But if you can just, you know, but I totally know what you're saying, because it is so nice and cozy and cuddly and comfortable and peaceful in bed. So
yeah.
So you're going to laugh at this, but I hope you do. So what I started writing, this has been on my mind for over a decade now, to write a poem called Ode to the Bed. So I started writing Ode to the Bed. It's a poem about, it's a poem about how you feel when you're in bed. And but I've shifted it. And so I started writing it from the point of view of the bed. And so now I'm going to, and I started it, and I was having a ball, you know. I've got a little bit of a rhythm to it, and the words are coming real easy and sweet, and it's just, it's going to be a cute little thing. So I'm not quite finished with it yet, but I wanted to enter it into some poetry contest. I think it'll get a few laughs. I love to help people laugh.
Do you
laugh.
Have that poem available? Do you have that poem available to read what you have?
It's not quite finished yet, but I'm going to finish it within the next couple of days, and then I can email to you. Yeah, if you send me your email, I will send it to you. In fact,
okay.
I will do even better. I will make a video of it and post it on YouTube, because you have to hear this. This is poetry that needs to be heard, not poetry that needs to be read. You know, it's like Carl Sandburg.
Yeah.
I totally fell in love with Carl Sandburg when I was in grade school, and I would go around through the house. You know, he wrote a poem called The Copper Wire, So I would go through the house in the rain and wet dripping, in the sun and shine drying a copper wire. And my dad just would look at me like I was totally crazy. And then my mom would bring out her favorite childhood poetry, you know, Hiawatha.
Yeah.
That was her thing. And we would have, you know, discussions about that, and then she'd give me this book, and you go, yes, you got to read Hiawatha. I mean, that's just the best poem ever, you know. And so we had a few moments like that when we could connect over poetry or music or something, or flowers, yeah.
Well, we're down to about 9 minutes, so I would like you to talk about your nuggets that you've left with us. You said you believe it's essential for survivors to identify our imprint, which I don't know exactly what that is, accepting the mindset, habits, and lifestyle patterns of our caregivers, and learn how to shift them so we can feel worthwhile, have fun, lead a life of creating as explained in the law of attraction. These imprints were absorbed by us as children, but need not to be a permanent part of our life philosophy. They belong to another time and place in the world of ascension, where we are right now. They must be cleared out of our energy field so that we can return to our life, wholesomeness.
Okay, yeah, I can explain that. I've been reading a books that talk about inherited ancestral trauma and inherited ancestral woundedness. And there are several of the books coming out now. And the one I'm recently reading that I love is called It Didn't Start With You by Mark Wolin. And he's talking about how he shifts. Sure. It Didn't Start With You. Mark Wolin, Wolynn.
Okay.
And the term imprints comes from the psychological field of doing this, working with inherited ancestral woundedness. And imprints means there's a genetic imprint and there's a behavioral imprint. And so when you're in your family and you picked up some of the genes through, you know, birth from your parents, and so maybe you have a gene toward anger or a gene toward alcohol or a gene toward whatever, you know. Some of that you pick up, but the rest of it you learn at home because you're in that home and family environment, and you're absorbing everything that your parents are seeing and doing and talking about and all the actions that happen in your family. You're absorbing all of that. You're trying to make sense out of it. That becomes your imprint. So my imprint was anger and sugar. My father was a sugar addict, and my mother was an anger addict. So when I get out into the world, what do I have? I have sugar and anger addiction issues because that's what I saw. That's what I absorbed in that family unit. So that is what has to be cleared out, and that is what is done through the type of hypnotherapy I do, which I call energy transfusions. And you can get rid of all that old crap so quickly. And it's not just anger and sugar, you know, it's not just diet, and it's not just angry at the world for your life, but it's also if you had a relative in your family who was a disgrace, then you have a little bit of shame and guilt that you carry with you all the time because that relative didn't fit and match to the society's views of what a male should be or what a, you know, warrior should be or something like that. So that's another imprint issue. And if you lost a relative early on in your life, then you have all that sadness and depression and was it my fault that this person died and now mom's gone or dad left the family because he ran off with another woman or whatever. So you're picking up all that emotional stuff that the family has not dealt with, you know, shame, depression, guilt, feeling abandoned, forlorn, whatever. There's all those society issues that's all your imprint too. So you have to clear all that out in order to move into the ascension. And the ascension is what is happening on the planet right now. And it has been going on for hundreds of years, but now everything is accelerating. It's accelerating at a very fast pace. And for us to move forward and to be part of this acceleration, which is what you want to do, because this is what takes us from 3D energy to 5D energy, and 5D is where you want to be. That's where the peace and love and bliss that we sang about in the 60s with Peter, Paul, and Mary, that's when this gels. This is when this really hits the planet and becomes part of who we are. Does that make sense?
To some degree, I remember Peter, Paul, and Mary. They sang Aquarius or something like that.
Yeah.
This is the age of Aquarius.
This is the age of Aquarius. Yeah. Well, Peter, Paul, and Mary sang lots of love songs because it was the war years, and so they were singing love and peace songs. And that's how they become real popular. It was not only their singing and their music style, but it was also they had the relevant times. They had the appropriate time in history. The world was ready for what they had to sing. And when I was in college, we would go and we would collect and gather together and we would sing Peter, Paul, and Mary songs.
Right.
And
well,
all the, and those
like
things.
That we've come full circle as child sexual abuse because, you know, we didn't have our songs back then. We didn't have a voice, but now we have our voice. So we can sing or declare or tell our stories. You know, we can be heard. You know, they were wanting to be heard for the times. We need to be heard for the times, right? So
yes.
I correlate that to that.
And yeah, and the ascension is preparing for the ascension, being part of the ascension, means you have to clear out all of those negative emotions that I just talked about, the anger, the fear, depression, guilt, shame, all that stuff. That all has to go because as long as that's in your energy field, that is what you're throwing out into the world. That's what you're attracting under the law of attraction. So the law of attraction is a tool to get you to clear.
Well, thank you for explaining that. We're less than 2 minutes. We don't have time to go back through the panel. I just want to ask one question, and then we're going to close. Just a brief answer. You said that therapy never helped you. Why didn't therapy help you?
Talk therapy never helped me. The kind of stuff where you go to a marriage and family counselor, you know, or you go to a shrink and all that stuff never did me any good. Because I just felt I was wasting my time and my money sitting there talking to this guy who didn't give a crap of what my life was about. He was just sitting there on the clock because he was getting paid $100 an hour. So
I didn't
feel
well,
a rapport with him, and he didn't have any tools to help me clear. That's why I went on my own journey.
Well, they didn't back then. That makes sense because back then they certainly didn't have, but, you know, we have trauma-informed therapists now, and, you know, I think people are trained to work with child trauma. So I want to thank our guest, Amber Deanne, for being on tonight and being so open and brave to come on and talk about her story. I want to thank Mark, John, and Julia, who listened only, for coming on and listening to story, and just leave us with one little nugget. Talk to the audience and tell the audience one thing before we go, Amber.
Sure. You have it within you to heal anything that's happened to you. You just have to shift your thoughts about it and then be willing to move into the world of adventure while you clear it out.
Awesome. How can people get in touch with you real quick? Do you have a website?
Website is coachingbyamber.com.
All righty. Well, from NASCA, this is Pamela Elaine Lockridge, your host, and I'm going to say good night. Everybody have a wonderful night.
Dog. had gone wrong. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Love Talk Radio.